Welcome back to Four Winds Fellowships. I'm Tim Warner. We are in episode number 15 now in our series on God and His Son. In the last several episodes, we have been kind of progressively working our way through the Gospel of John, looking at all of the pre-existence language that John's Gospel uses of Christ, beginning, of course, in the prologue, and then working our way through. One of the things that we focused on was the statements about Christ coming down from heaven, where he specifically referred to that in chapter 6. You know, he says, I have come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of the one who sent me, which read literally indicates that Christ existed in heaven before he came down to earth. We looked at some of the language about his descending and ascending. For example, in John 3:13, where the apostle writes, no one has ascended into heaven except the one who descended from heaven, that is, the Son of Man. And so we see that John juxtaposes descending from heaven with ascending from heaven. This is a literary device where two things are being contrasted that are opposite one another. And one of the points that I made when we were looking at that passage and a few others is that whenever these things are juxtaposed like that, you cannot have one of them be literal and the other be figurative. They both have to be literal in order to be contrasted. So Christ ascending to heaven, we know that he literally, bodily ascended to heaven. His whole person went to heaven, changed locations. And that's what the word ascended, or the phrase ascended to heaven referred to in John 3:13. So when it says no one has descended except the one who ascended, it's clear that descended is in the same sense. That is, he actually changed locations. He came from heaven to earth. There's no legitimate way to contrast the ascending and descending in that passage unless both of those things are literal, despite what biblical Unitarians claim, where they try to make one figurative and the other one literal. Well, there are similar contrasting statements that we see in John that are not just about descending and ascending, but coming forth from God and going to God, or going back to God. And I want to look at some of that language today. In fact, today I would like in this lesson to finish out the Gospel of John with these things. All right, so let's look at the screen. I have John 6:46 up on the screen. It says, not that anyone has seen the Father except he who is from God. Now, there's many statements in John about him being from God. And you can take that in a couple of different ways. You can say, well, from God simply means that God commissioned him or God sent him. It doesn't necessarily mean he changed locations. And that is true. All right, that is a true statement. It doesn't necessarily mean that. However, there are other indications in this particular passage and these other passages we're going to look at that prove that he is talking about coming from the Father, from the presence of the Father in heaven and coming to earth. So these statements have the same effect as John 3:13 and the other statements about, you know, Jesus coming down from heaven and going back to heaven. All right, they have exactly the same effect, but they're doing it using slightly different language, right? Excuse me. So in John 6:46, what is it there that implies that he's talking about actually coming from heaven to earth when he says he who is from God? And as the next clause, he has seen the Father. So, you know, we have the statement in John 1:18, no one has seen God at any time, the only begotten Son who's in the Father's bosom, this one has declared him or made him known. So he's in the Father's bosom now, but he has come forth from the Father and he has seen the Father. And so that statement that he has seen the Father, here, he has seen the Father, he is setting himself apart from everyone else, including all of the prophets who came before him, who were sent by God, sort of in an indirect way, they weren't in heaven and then sent down to earth by God, but they were actually sent by God. So in one sense, you could say they were from God, all the prophets, but Jesus is from God in a different sense. And he has seen the Father, which indicates or implies that he has actually been with the Father and seen the Father's face, because he was, in fact, in heaven before he came to earth, right? Just as all those descended and ascended passages also indicate. Well, let's look at John 8:42. Now, this is from the LGV, and I'm putting this one in here because it has it's slightly different sense, but it's important because it's not translated completely accurately in most translations. So let's look at this. It says, Jesus said to them, if God was your Father, you were loving me, or you would love me, would be sort of the sense. For I issued forth out of God and am come. Now, this statement, I issued forth out of God, is talking about Christ's own origin, that he was literally begotten out of God. And this, of course, refers to Psalm 2, where God says, you are my son, today I have begotten you. It refers to Proverbs 8, where we have this person speaking, claiming to have been begotten out of God as the beginning of God's works, and being a master craftsman working alongside God as he formed all things, and being before all things, and so forth. We see that in Proverbs 8, 22 through 33, I believe it is. So this I issued forth out of God is a reference to his beginning. And of course, John uses that only begotten son language as well in reference to his begetting. Okay, so I issued forth out of God is not a reference to him coming to earth, but the next clause is, and am come. So first I issued forth out of God, then I am come, is what this passage states. Well, John 13:3, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that, notice this, he had come from God and was going to God. Now, I want you to note that these two statements are juxtaposed. That is, they are being held up as mirror images of one another for the purpose of contrasting. So what did Jesus mean when he said, or what did John mean when he says that Jesus was going to God? It means he was going to ascend to heaven. Jesus knew that he was going to ascend to heaven in fulfillment of Psalm 110:1, right? The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. So this is what Jesus knew. He understood he was going to be ascending to heaven. But look at what is put in contrast, or the exact opposite of that. He had come from God. He had come from God. Now, what I'm going to show, and we get down into some of these other verses here, is the word erkomai, exerkomai, which always, it's used like 30 times in John's gospel. It always means to leave a place, right? To depart from a thing or a building or a city or something like that. It means to leave a place, to be in a new place. All right, that's what that word means. And so every time you see this in blue, it's that word exerkomai. All right, so he says he had come, literally left the presence of God, and he was going back to God. All right, you can see this is exactly the opposite of this. It's not correct to say that, well, we recognize he was going to God in reference to his ascension to heaven, but then we're going to claim that he came from God only in some sense that, you know, maybe God appeared to him in a vision and sent him something like that. No, this refers to a change of location. All right, this word, this Greek word here, exerkomai, always refers to a change in location in relation to your surroundings. All right, it always means that in the scriptures. All right, let's look at John 16:27. For the Father himself, and this is the passage, I believe, that completely blows away the biblical Unitarians' attempt, and I should say attempt, at explaining away all of this language in John's gospel, all of this ascending, descending, coming from heaven, all that stuff. They try to find other ways to explain it away so that it doesn't mean that Christ literally pre-existed in heaven. They have all kinds of creative ways to try to do that. They're quite creative at doing it, I'll give them that, but none of it holds water. And this passage, in my opinion, completely shatters that interpretation. Look what it says here. This is Jesus talking to his disciples. He's telling them that he's going away. He's been telling them that in John 14 through 16. But then he says, for the Father himself loves you because you have loved me and have believed that, notice this, I came forth from God. Again, came forth, it's the same Greek word. It means to change locations. I came forth from God. That is, he left the presence, the location of God. Where is God? Well, how did Jesus tell us to pray? Our Father who art in heaven, right? God's place is heaven. Yes, his spirit extends into the world, but his place is heaven. That's what the Bible teaches. Notice he says it again. I is a person, Christ himself. I came forth, change locations, from the Father, who is in heaven, and have come into the world. Now notice we have these contrasting things. I came forth from the Father and come into the world. He's no longer with the Father. He's now in the world. A change, complete change of location. Then he contrasts this. He says exactly the opposite. Again, I leave the world and go to the Father. Again, this is exactly the same situation that we have in John 3:13 between ascended versus descended, right? No one has ascended into heaven except the one who descended from heaven. That is Christ, the Son of Man. So look what his disciples said to him. His disciples said to him, see, now you are speaking plainly and using no figure of speech. This is not a figure of speech. This is not a metaphor that he came forth from God. That is, he relocated from God, from beside God, and he came into the world. This is not, is speaking plainly, and it is using no figure of speech. This is absolute proof that biblical Unitarians are wrong in how they interpret all of this language in John's gospel. It's settled right here. Now we are sure that you know all things and have no need that anyone should question you. By this, we believe that, and again, they reemphasize what Jesus said. We believe that you came forth, that is, changed locations. You left the location where God was. You came forth from God. That's what that means. It doesn't mean, again, this clause does not mean that God just appeared to you and sent you as he did with some of the prophets. It's not what it means. It means he was in the presence of God where God is repeatedly said to be located, right? Heaven is my throne, earth is my footstool, is what Isaiah says. All right. All right, now let's look at John 17:8, and then we're gonna look at John 17 in a little bit more detail. John 17 is of course Jesus' prayer, which follows the next chapter after John 16, which we've been looking at here. Jesus then prays to the Father. This is a pretty long prayer. It's a whole chapter of this prayer. But look what he says here. He says, "For I have given to them the words which you have given me, and they have received them, and have known surely that," notice this exact same language we see here, "I came forth from you." Ex erkomi. I came forth. I left where you are and came here. And they have believed that you sent me. All right. This is absolute proof of preexistence. That preexistence runs through the entire fabric of John's gospel, beginning in chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. All of these things are confirming the very first statement in the Gospel of John, that Logos, the Word, was with God, and the Word was God. That is, he's a person. The word God always refers to a person, not the same person as God himself, but he was God to those he encountered, because he was God's agent, as God's representative. He was God to Adam, he was God to Abraham, he was God to Moses, and all the patriarchs and so forth. All right, well, let's take a look at more of John 17 in the next slide here. This one second, I have to, let me close out this one. I think it'll go to that one. There we go. All right, in John 17, which we are looking at, in verse 3, notice the language Jesus uses at the beginning of his prayer. He says, yet this is age enduring life, that they may know you, again, that is the Father, the only true God. And of course, this is a critical statement. This statement is proof that Jesus himself recognized that he was not equal to his Father in the sense of being co-eternal. Christ was not co-eternal with the Father. Christ, the Son of God, had a beginning at the beginning of creation, as we see in Proverbs chapter 8. But the only true God is the Father. He's the only eternal God. He is the only one who is God in the fullest extent of the term God, which refers to the sovereign. Okay, God is the sovereign over all things because he created all things, he existed before all things, and so forth. This is what the true God is in reference to. And he's the only true God. All right, as non-Trinitarians, we recognize that the Father alone is the eternal God, the source of everything else that exists, including his own Son, to whom he gave existence at the beginning of creation, and the one whom you sent, Jesus the Anointed. So eternal life is in acknowledging these two things. You have to acknowledge the one true God, and you have to acknowledge the one who he sent. And where did he send him from? He sent him from heaven, right? That's what we've been looking at here. I glorified you upon the land. I finished the work which you have given me, so that I may complete it. And now you, Father, glorify me beside yourself. Now, what's interesting here, well, actually, let me finish. Glorify me beside yourself with the glory which I was having beside you before what the world was to be, or before the world was, some translations have it. All right, so he's talking about the time period prior to the Son fashioning the world along with his Father as the protege, you might say, of the Father. There was a period of time when God beget the Son before they began to create all things together. And what I want you to notice is this word beside here. Now, in Greek, it's the preposition para. But the preposition para can have a couple of different nuances depending on whether the word that it modifies, or its object, I should say, because prepositions take an object, that's the word that follows them, whether that preposition is in the genitive case or whether it's in the dative case. Now, that has to do with spelling. It has to do with its function in the sentence. We're not going to get into all that grammar, but just take my word for it, or if you have software that allows you to parse the language, you can confirm it, that the word yourself, that is the object of this preposition, is in the dative case. Same here, the object of the preposition para here is translated beside, which is you, is in the dative case, not in the genitive case. All right. In the, if it was in the genitive case, it could mean, just like, you know, John the Baptist, there was a man sent from God whose name was John. All right. Para vespera, which could mean from. Okay, from, not that he was in God's presence, but God sent him on a mission, doesn't really require this really close, absolute personal closeness in location. Doesn't necessarily, if this was in the genitive case, but it's in the dative case. And in the dative case, it means beside. All right, so pros here, or excuse me, para means from beside you, that is in your presence. So not, what's interesting is that we have this twice in this verse. And again, this is one of those places where we have a juxtaposition of ideas. Okay, now juxtaposition is for comparison, and they have to be apples to apples, not apples to oranges, right? So he says, glorify me beside yourself with the glory I was having beside you. Again, same thing, before the world was, or what the world was. So what this means is, whatever it meant here, it also has to mean here. And when he's saying, glorify me beside yourself, Jesus is referencing, again, Psalm 110, verse 1, right? The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. Christ is at the right hand of God. We've, that passage is cited so many times in the New Testament, more than any other Old Testament passage, that Psalm 110:1 is referenced in the New Testament. And this is what Jesus is referring to, that the Father would glorify him beside himself, in his location, at his right hand. Whatever beside yourself means here, which Jesus is talking about the future, in fulfillment of Psalm 110:1, must be the same meaning as beside you here. If this requires Jesus' actual existence and personal presence beside God, then so does this. And this was before the world was. Christ had glory beside the Father before the world was, that is, before all these things were created during those 6 days. He had glory beside the Father, and he's now praying for that same glory to be restored to him beside yourself, beside the Father, again, after his crucifixion, his resurrection, and his ascension, which he knows is in front of him. All right, again, proof of preexistence is right here. Again, biblical Unitarians find all kinds of creative ways to try to explain it away, but it doesn't work with the grammar. It doesn't work with just simple logic. They end up having to compare apples with oranges in these things. All right. Now, look at verse 24 in Jesus' prayer. Father, I desire those whom you have given me, that where I am, these also may be with me, so that, look at this, they may see my glory, which you gave me. Again, this is the glory he's talking about in his coming kingdom. He wants them to accompany him in his coming kingdom and see this glory that he had beside the Father before the world was, and which is being restored to him again when he ascends to heaven to be seated at the right hand of God. He wants his disciples to see him in that glory. But notice, it's the glory which you gave me. It's not Christ's own glory. It's the glory that's bestowed upon him by the Father. And then he says, because you loved me before the overthrow of the world. Now, I know I don't want to get into this language here. Some translations, most translations say before the foundation of the world. That's not a correct translation. It literally means an overthrow, something thrown down, and it's talking about before the curse was placed upon the creation. So God loved his Son from the very first instant of day one of creation, when he was begotten out of God. God loved his Son And in fact, in Proverbs 8, it says that he took delight in his son. When they were creating, he was beside God as a master craftsman. And it says specifically there that God was delighting in him daily. That is, according to the 6 days of creation, God was delighting in this person who is his son in Proverbs 8. And that was before the overthrow of the world, or before the curse was placed on the world. And then everything that God had declared was good, which God created through his son, it was all good. The world was pronounced good, and then it was overthrown and the curse was placed upon it. And now the world is no longer good, which is why we're commanded to love not the world nor the things that are in the world. It's because it has been corrupted and the curse is placed upon it until Christ redeems us and redeems our bodies from the curse, which is death, and redeems the curse from the world itself, from the ground. All right. Now, the final thing I want to mention in this lesson is what John says at the very end of his book about the purpose why he wrote his gospel. And it's really, really important that we understand John's purpose in writing his gospel, because that's in dispute. Biblical Unitarians have their own rather, I would say, convoluted explanation of John's purpose in writing his gospel. It's not borne out by what the early Christians said about John's purpose. It's something that's entirely fabricated in order to give them some kind of a foundation for denying all of this pre-existence language. But I want you to just look at what John says here about his purpose. All right, here's his purpose. And truly, Jesus did many other things in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written, and that includes all of this language we've been looking at. These are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. What I want you to see here is that there are two things that you must believe, two things about who Jesus is. Jesus is the Christ. Jesus is the Son of God. These two things are not necessarily synonymous. What does it mean to be the Christ? The word the Christ is the Christos in Greek. It's Mashiach or Messiah in Hebrew. And it's a reference to being the seed of David that was promised to David, who would sit on David's throne and reign over the house of Israel forever. That particular son of David. So Jesus is the Christ is a statement about his humanity. It's a statement that he is the one that fulfills the promise to Abraham. He's the one that fulfills the promise to David to sit upon that throne and to fulfill that. But the Son of God has a different connotation. Now, it is true that the kings of Israel could be called a son of God, just as we are called sons of God. But there's a difference between that language and what John refers to as the only begotten Son of God. He uses a title that works only with this one person who is called the Son of God, and it's the only begotten Son of God, the one that came forth out of God's own being, the one who Jesus referred to himself when he said, I issued forth out of God and have come, in John 8:42. All right, that's the kind of begotten son that we're talking about here. That's the one who was in the beginning with God, who was begotten at the beginning of creation. You are my son, today I have begotten you, Psalm 2, verse 7. Proverbs 8, 22 through 25. The son speaking says, before God made any of these things, he begets me. And then I was with him as a master craftsman. All that is being referenced in John 1. You know, without him, not anything was made, and so forth. So the Son of God is a reference to Psalm 2. It's a reference to Proverbs 8. And it has a more nuanced meaning than just Jesus is the Christ. To say Jesus is the Christ is simply acknowledging his humanity, his descent from the seed of David, and that was through Mary, through his mother, who was a descendant of David, and the one whom God has appointed to reign on the throne of Israel. That's what it means that Jesus is the Christ. But the Son of God, this is a phrase that unfortunately biblical Unitarians do not understand and do not acknowledge correctly. They'll say all day long they believe Jesus is the Son of God, but they don't believe Jesus is the begotten Son of God. They believe Jesus is the adopted Son of God, and that is a totally different connotation than what John's Gospel loudly proclaims through all of this stuff that we have been studying as we have worked through this, through all these lessons in John. So the point I want to make here in closing, I'm not saying biblical Unitarians aren't saved. I think they're grossly mistaken about what this phrase means, the Son of God. I think they're grossly mistaken about that. And I think that their bad theology has a severe, creates a severe detriment to how those who follow that theology interact with God. I believe they are, most of them are true believers and they are truly saved. I just think they have shot themselves in the foot by not acknowledging the true doctrine of what it means to be the only begotten Son of God. And it's a great detriment to the gospel of the kingdom that they proclaim. They teach the gospel of the kingdom, but they don't acknowledge the Son of God in his true full colors, if you will, of who he truly is and what he truly did. Anyway, all right, so I'm not going to belabor that point, but next time we're going to start looking at wisdom. We briefly mentioned Proverbs 8, what it says about wisdom there. We're going to look at that passage, and then we're going to work our way through, just like we did in this set, we looked at Genesis 1 to see the creation, and then we went into John's Gospel and looked how John wove that whole creation narrative into, you know, this person called Logos, and then who Logos really was, and how he came to earth, he became flesh, all these things. We're going to do the same with Proverbs 8. We're going to look at that passage, and then we're going to show how the Apostle Paul borrowed from that passage and preached Jesus Christ out of that passage. He linked him to that person described in Proverbs 8, 22 through 31, as being an actual person who actually existed and through whom God created all things. All right, and then redeemed, or is redeeming all things through that same person that was with him at the very beginning. All right. Anyway, hope you enjoyed that. God bless, and we'll see you next time.